Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by the host with the most, the Hall of Famer, the difference maker, Mr. Tony Sager. Tony, how are you, sir?
Great, Sean, and it's great to be back with you.
Absolutely. We are doing one of our, which it seems rare now, Tony, just me and you having a conversation.
Exactly.
Seems like we're always got guests and we're always talking about topics. We never get chance to just have a one-on-one. But what we decided to do today was take a look at the predictions that were made earlier in 2025, see how we're doing. Now, one of my little thoughts here, Tony, something to discuss is I always like looking at the Verizon data breach investigation report just to see if I was even close. And we've got some interesting input there. And obviously we have, input data elements into such a phenomenal product. Big shout out over there to the Verizon data breach investigation report team. Phil Langlois, you know, a member of the CIS family, him and his team do such phenomenal work. Gives us really an idea, Tony, of whether these predictions are either coming true or maybe they need to maturate for the rest of the year to see true fruition.
Sure. Yeah. You know, predictions always come true. It's just you never know when, though.
Exactly.
There's a certain danger in it. But but going back to a source like Verizon, again, good partners of ours for over a decade now. And they're number one on my recommended list for folks who are trying to get a sense for what's happening in the industry. So lots of data, lots of great analysis, good writing. You know, there's no better place to start. And maybe it'll both enlighten and occasionally humble us in terms of what the data shows.
Exactly. Exactly. So, Tony, if it's all right with you, I'm going to go to what we published. So this was the 12 CIS expert cybersecurity predictions for 2025. What I call it, I rename it, I say 11 security experts and Sean for 2020. just for fun. But we had on that particular blog post material that was provided, Marcy Andino, a VP here at CIS, she'd really focused on generative artificial intelligence, where she was looking at it being a vector to improve both velocity and veracity necessarily of phishing campaigns and the utility necessarily from an adversarial perspective. She also goes on to say that it's not all bad. You know, we can use it for good as well, you know, as we're using it internally. And she's also talking about a very interesting topic. One, we've talked to John Cohen multiple times, him and his team doing phenomenal work in the multidimensional threat space. She's looking at different tactics in this area and really how information and physical attacks and these campaigns go through that process. And, you know, as we've gone through the year, Tony, obviously generative AI, it's either on the tip of everybody's tongue or at the, they're being told by the computer that this is the next big thing, is very important. We've seen a lot of use in the space, and even going back to the Verizon data breach report, we'll link the executive summary. And as Tony had recommended, please go download such a great utility. But one of the things that I found very interesting with this is in that report, it breaks down service and the utility that have started to be seen from an internal perspective. But it also added this particular element that I thought was very, very interesting about the number of non-corporate emails utilizing generative AI for maybe corporate use as well. So maybe it's not improved internally, but I'm going to bypass that and use it anyway, but use a personal account. Got to be so careful in this space with data loss and exposure, specifically what we're generatively creating or asking questions about what type of data we're putting in that space. So I thought that was a very interesting perspective that Verizon had taken with that assessment. But yeah, I mean, we're seeing a generative AI being used throughout many campaigns. I think we're past the poor grammar and the broken English in emails now. That's old hat. That's kind of like talking about antivirus instead of EDR now. It's an old nomenclature in the phishing space. Any thoughts there, Tony?
It's hard to imagine a more direct and useful use case for generative AI than the creation of phishing emails. You know, and in the case of where you have, and we've seen lots of them that have no information about the target, right? They're sort of blind things. And or their attempt to target in a very vague way. You know, here's the invoice for your recent purchase of McAfee, right? You know, they'll pick on, or here's your cancellation of your account at Amazon, right? They don't know that the potential victim has that account, but the odds are pretty good. So these are just kind of spray and pray and hope that these things work. But this idea of taking whatever information you have and then being able to more finely target the context of the potential victims. And to be able to do that essentially, you know, automatically, is just incredibly powerful. And it's one of the ironic things that you have to deal with, Sean, is that if you look at the emergence of new tech, both new technology and the management of risk, but also, you've heard me say this before, if you want to study capitalism, you don't study the good guys, you study the bad guys. You know, there's a certain... because their objectives are clear, there's a certain Darwinian efficiency, right? You know, who's the cheapest provider? Why would I build a tool when I could rent time on a tool? Why'd I do recon if I could just buy it? You know what? And so you see this kind of natural specialization in the hunt for efficiency, right? Because there's a very clear economic model here of either disruption or theft or whatever's going on. So you see quicker adoption of both technology and ideas. And, you know, bad guys, they don't worry so much about those pesky policies that your group puts out. And they're not too worried about, you know, data commingling or dealing with oversight and compliance. Imagine all that. And so their ability to adapt really quickly, you know, is just, it's not surprising, but the scale of it is just startling. And so that's what they're going to do. You know, and Marcy's point that we're going to see that makes sense because it's just such a natural use case for it. And on the flip side, you know, she's right. I mean, not all is lost here. That, you know, and I think this will probably come up. I know it came up in multiple predictions, but you know, you and I both know there is so much overwhelming grunt work in defense of just getting data from A to B and correlating C, D, and F, and you know, kind of moving, observing, matching, all this work that mostly, you know, the great integration engine of cyber defense is you poor human beings. I mean, we overwork them to the point of ridiculousness. And so the ability to do that at greater scale, greater automation, you know, it's really been a need for decades in cybersecurity. So we've explored a lot of those ideas internally. And of course, many across the industry have done the same. So yeah, but adoption will, I think, always be slower on the defensive side for lots of reasons. We're not going to abandon oversight and compliance. We're not going to get rid of policies. But we also have to recognize that that's another part of the risk equation. So some of us, you know, grew up in a world where we said, hey, the government's going to use new technology. We can add an extra year to the timeline so we can study it to make sure that's safe to use. Well, that's an entire refresh cycle now in the industry, right? No one's waiting a year for government wonks to tell them that a new piece of tech is safe. So if you are slow in adoption, you're maybe dealing with one risk, the risk that there's flaws in software or whatever that you're trying to deal with, but you're now taking on a different risk, the risk of, you know, the rapid turnover of technology, the inability to quickly put in place new defenses or access to new information that would improve your current defenses. So there's no free lunch in any of this business here. And I think, but it is fascinating to watch the generative AI stuff play out because it, you know, it sort of brings it all into kind of a nice, neat discussion.
It certainly does. It certainly does. And it, you know, it's easy to opine on some of those elements as well, where we, you know, really trying to push a narrative of being agile in the space as well to react in time. But as you mentioned, Tony, some of the limitations that, you know, risk governance and control strategy puts onto defender capability and adaption and even adaptation to this this underlying threat environment, it incurs a need for potentially shifting approaches in terms of how we assess. And it really goes into one of my predictions here was this element of supply chain risk management, where we've talked, Tony, about the shift left element. And we know CISA has put out a number of articles and some thought leadership in that space of how we move to reduce vulnerability in the, you know, as a root cause, leading to what Verizon Data Breach talks about, 30% from both third party, including software vulnerability, as part of what they've seen in their attacks in their report. What it leads us to is really trying to move between having to create such a robust control program on the implementation is let's move that requirement backward, as it were, to the you know, original equipment manufacturing, the software development, the deployers of the software. So necessarily our velocity can increase because we know we can utilize certain capabilities without incurring kind of this vulnerability debt when we install and utilize such technologies. It may help us react to the attacker's use of a capability versus a need to have all of these controls, because partly, you know, there's certain vendor due diligence and alignment to better controls that potentially is needed.
No, I think, you know, and of course, you live this this challenge every day, Sean, and your work as a, you know, a CISO here. And I think, you know, one of the things that strikes me about your points, which are on the money, is that you have to think of this as a dynamic risk problem, right? You know, again, an older model said, we will study the technology, we will vet the vendor, right? We'll take a lot of time, really, a lot of time and money and control in order to have greater confidence in the things that we do. And that makes sense if you have lots of time, lots of money, and lots of control of the environment. And in today's world, we have none of those three. Right? We don't have enough money or time or control of the environment. And so we're accepting risk. And you want to be able to manage that intelligently. And I think one thing that's often missing is the flip side of the equation, right? The adversary's risk. So they have their own risk model, which is a different one than the defenders. And they want to be have some level of confidence in what they're going to do also. So I'm going to cartoon it a bit here, but I wrote a thought piece once on the that I shared with the DOD. And by the way, I got laughed out of the room, but I was right. Just to let you know, I said, I just proposed a thought piece. Imagine if the Defense Department was a nimble adopter of technology, right? Could quickly take what's happening in the market and bring it into place, quickly be able to reconfigure our systems, quickly be able to know what we have and move things in and out of the environment. You actually create a tremendous problem for the adversary because they have to do reconnaissance. They have to spend money to create technology, to do the implanting on your network, to create an infrastructure right inside your network. And so dynamic change by the defender affects the risk that the adversary is willing to take on. And so you have to think of that. I said, I wasn't proposing that will never happen, but it was, I thought, worthwhile as a thought experiment to say, if we could do more things under our control when we choose, could we choose them in a way to raise adversary uncertainty? Because they don't like uncertainty either, right? They want to know that if they, you know, use up a hard-to-find, expensive zero day in a complex set of tools that are wrapped in a complex set of tools that they had to develop, they want to have pretty high certainty it's going to work. And so that, and if they don't like uncertainty on the defender, then they have to attack you in a place that has more permanence which is usually in the life cycle, right? They want to, then they have to figure out, where do you get your software? You know, if it's going to change, I want to get to the source before it changes so I can do it. Anyway, so this idea of thinking of risk as a two-sided thing and dynamically, you know, that's what you expressed. So you have one enterprise's supply chain problem that you're trying to manage, but you, from a kind of a national perspective, you want to say, what I want is a environment where I can lower the cost and the time to access a new supplier. And I don't want to spend a year figuring out how to vet and apply a new, because you've just created a different risk, right? The risk that you're now driving up your business costs or other things. So this is what you live, right? I think you have a meeting today on this topic of managing risk, both of security and for the business, and to be able to say, you know, I could demand another 6 months of study so I feel better about it, but maybe I've driven my risk to a place that I can it's no longer visible to me, and that's not good, right? Maybe I'd be better with a more agile, repeatable, quickly be able to change suppliers, with a well-defined set of requirements and I've designed my enterprise to be agile, right, for new suppliers to come and go. You have created a tremendous problem for adversaries, for lots of classes of attacks, not all attacks. And so I think, you know, looking at it holistically, as a complex risk problem with dynamics is something we have not gotten to, I don't think, yet in the industry. And by the way, these are really hard problems that we're struggling with. But there are none of these problems are ones that we can solve on our own as an enterprise or that anybody else can. These are really systemic kind of issues here. But I think, you know, you've lived these problems of, how much control can I assert over my suppliers without causing problems elsewhere, right? The balloon starts expanding over in this direction or that direction. And that is, you know, that's one of the beautiful things that will keep risk engineers going for years, I think.
Exactly. Where our friends over at Sierra will help us analyze and use a data-driven approach to assess that risk.
I think that's right, yeah. Yeah. The gut feeling is certainly not cutting it for us.
Exactly. Well, let's take a quick break, Tony. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of the other predictions going through zero trust, IT/OT, some elements of quantum here. And again, we've overemphasized some of the AI pieces, but some interesting approaches. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Operating systems in the cloud are vulnerable to malware, misconfiguration, and more. That is, unless you securely configure them. Enter the CIS Hardened Images. These virtual machine images come pre-hardened to the CIS benchmarks, providing built-in security and compliance you can trust. Available at less than 3 cents per compute hour, CIS Hardened Images save you time and money managing your cloud security posture. Available on all major cloud service platforms. So spin one up today by visiting cisecurity.org.
Okay, Tony. So we come back. Jason Emery had gone through. He's looking at AI-assisted cybersecurity tools, which we've kind of touched on. He'd also mentioned some thoughts in governance in terms of K-12, really looking at adaptation and looking at controls from NIST and CIS in terms of how these can be strategic and the utility of these elements are, in some cases, the adage is that it becomes it's not a revenue generation element, but it is revenue protection. And I think there's a big distinguishing factor there that necessarily we could also address in terms of the review. Very, very important to understand when we're thinking about cybersecurity, it's not just the strain on money and you're taking resources from sales and from, you know, marketing and us doing other things. Yeah, I get that from, you know, certain parenthetics within infrastructure. But it also requires us to really start to think about how we're protecting and taking responsibility. There is a due diligence as we've digitized all of this necessarily work and this business value, that value be protected. So it is a strategic investment and not just a loss in the space where we think the money could be put to better utility I think, Tony, there's a big play here, and especially as we talked risk just a moment ago, where we could say, well, I'll invest in a new marketing campaign versus investing in a new security control. Looking at the return on investment from both sides of that house can have different consequences based on actions and activities from our adversarial threats. And without taking that into consideration from a financial or budgeting perspective, I think is maybe looking at the problem in the wrong way and looking, you know, maybe opening our eyes to these types of risks, which we've talked about are true business risks, not just the technology or that's, you know, it's a security risk, nothing to do with how we run the business. And I think that's a little bit myopic.
Yeah, I'd agree. You know, what it's been part of the thinking at CIS, you know, and you've been a part of this for the last couple of years around the role of, I'll call it the leverage points or the enforcement points in the ecosystem, right? Whether it's public policy, insurance, the legal system. You know, in the early days of this, it was all kind of magic and mystery. You know, bad guys are, oh my gosh, how could I possibly protect myself against 10-foot tall foreign, you know, nation state attackers? And, you know, there was just a lot of terminology that was not common terminology and magic, really, the wizardry model of security I've talked about, you know, I know I'm here on the podcast. And, but, you know, this is long past the point of exactly what you described, right? These are business issues. And it's hard to imagine a modern business that is not wholly dependent upon IT and access to the worldwide internet. That's how wealth is generated, found, shared, moved, et cetera. And so it's not, here's our business idea, and we're going to need some IT to help us get there. It is bound, right? The IT is bound into the business thinking and projection. And I think now it's taken, we're still in the process of maturing what that looks like. And so you've got all these kind of odd things that if you looked at physical space, you wouldn't put up with, right? We wouldn't leave everybody on their own in this nation to worry about things like physical safety when you walk into a building, right? We have managed most of the risk through the infrastructure, through building codes and strength of materials and certified human beings and accepted bodies of knowledge or and so forth. And so we've been relatively slow in the what we now call the cyber domain to achieve that same level of thinking, right? What is the expectation of a citizen in terms of protection of their information, their wealth, their identity, and so forth? And there are plenty of technical solutions, but why don't people invest in them? And we've I think for too long used the scare model, right? If we just scared people enough, they would be so inspired, they will go fix this. Well, that has not had any long-term effect as near as I can tell. And by the way, I was professionally, you know, paid to scare people with these clever, you know, oh, we found another zero day, we did the red team and all that stuff. But my observation is that people are impressed when you describe what you did. And then they go back to their day job and they're besieged by business issues, mission imperatives, higher priorities, right? Things that have a clear payoff. And so it now enters a competitive space and it doesn't compete well, right? The sort of the model that is competing directly against revenue generating ideas. And yet there really feels like, and there is a need for, I mean, that's why we spend a lot of effort on reasonable cybersecurity and activities like that to try and bridge this gap to public policy to say, you know, and one approach would be to be, hey, this is important for everybody's economic health. We're going to mandate, you know, this kind of behavior by the entire population. Number one, politically, it's never going to happen. Two, no one's quite sure what that behavior is. And so, you know, it's hard to mandate what you don't, you know, what you can't define. And so, so it's sort of left to us to figure out what is a rational social expectation for all this. And meanwhile, you know, good folks like you are kind of juggling your job, right, is to bridge that gap between sort of technical planning, implementation, and decision making, both at an executive level with our team, but also with the board and with our potential suppliers or folks that we want to be a supplier to. And so you have to have a consistent way to both manage the technical improvement program, but also the how that is presented, right? Is it accessible to people who are trying to make a decision about us? Are we a safe supplier, for example? And so that's why I think no schmooze here, Sean, but I have tremendous respect for the job that you do, because you're really right at that intersection. And so you got to sort through the technical stuff, right? You can't ignore it. At the same time, you got to be the speaker to boards. You got to be able to present this in a coherent way to people that don't live and breathe, you know, the technology part of it. So all that, I wandered a bit here, but I think, you know, again, the tools that we have, I guess exciting possibility is that we have tremendous instrumentation and tooling that we did not have just a few years ago. We have access to more information. There's, you know, we used to spend all of our time worrying about how do we get people to care about security? Well, people lose enough money, they care about security, right? Or they, you know, they see the effects of it. So we're kind of past the scariest stage. But I do think this now crafting, how do we turn this into something where we know how a lot of the risk is managed without asking everyone to be an expert in it, is really, we're still running short of that, I think. And you know, that is why, you know, we built relationships. You mentioned CIRA, the Society of Information Risk Analysts, you know, friends of CIS. And, you know, so we've reached out to other parties who are thinking of this, maybe more quantitatively, maybe more in the context of business decision-making, like the NACD or folks like that. And I think that's a really important part of it, is that we have to reach out to places like that, because they are grappling with these problems, whether they know about folks like us or not. So better for us to try and bridge that gap than leave it there and hope for the best.
Completely agree. Well, Tony, we only got through a few predictions. The way it leads to me, I'll go through some of the other ones really quickly as we conclude this. But I think, Tony, the reason why I say I think a lot of what has been discussed is really aligned to those predictions having an element of accuracy. Now, if they're, you know, 100%, they're very much aligned with a narrative. And just my experience at RSA this year gave that, you know, similar thoughts in the space. So, you know, we'll talk Don Freely, a VP of IT services who, you know, is living in this space as well, looking at zero trust advances, looking at secure by design elements, you know, that we talked about. We also talked to Stephen Jensen with respect to his prediction, and he's looking very much at IoT, how it's affecting data collection and management, and really thinking about those being attack vectors, avenues for attack, utilizing both the IoT from a consumer perspective, but also I think, you know, if we went down the path of industrial IoT, really comes back to something Jason Emery had mentioned as well about this IT-OT-ICS convergence, where we're starting to see threat vectors in that space. And we see these become targets. And you know, we're going through socio-political elements right now where these become kind of full-framed. These are targets of opportunity for nation states, for alignment from hacktivism, with respect to a religion, a state, a people, a country, an idea, a continent, those types of things. These become opportunities that we see that need protection. And so I think Jason and Stephen hit that out of the park with their thoughts. Angelo goes down a path, and it's very important, where we've seen both evangelization, which obviously I defer to the master on the call here, but he's really talking about awareness and really creating this culture of responsibility. And I that's not done without an evangelization of why it matters. I mean, we've kind of talked about that, Tony, right? There's a risk proposition that we need to review. And I think it's very important to align to Angelo's thoughts here. It's, he's looking at this being a baseline foundational element, is if we're not talking about the right things, the being the first line of defense, creating the human firewall, as it were, that this empowers basically us to make decisions. We make them every day with every click of an email we take or Slack message or whatever it happens to be. those permeate necessarily responsibility, because behind them, there's a whole plethora of technology, code, infrastructure that is either aligned and controlled or is vulnerable and risky. And with each click, it leads us down that path. And I don't know that we think about it that way, right? You know, it was just a click on my computer. No big deal. But having an awareness that permeates this, a screen, naturally goes back to how it has an influence on business, I think is very important.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've had mixed feelings about the whole awareness activity over the history of the business, right? That, you know, and I pardon my grammar, I will often say, we're not going to awareness our way out of this problem. Yet, it is an essential part of any activity to, when you look at camp, and I know these are bumper stickery things, but remember Ford, quality is job one and things like that, right? It was both a message to the world, but it's a message to the workforce that everyone has an impact on the quality of the product that comes out of the company. And everyone's reputation, right? Our reputation as professionals is tied to the quality of the product here. And so this idea of security as something really important. So if people were sloppy with our accounting or our handling of our cash or our invoicing, that's unacceptable behavior. You could not allow that inside a company. And yet, you know, so can one person stop every phishing? No, but they could do their part. And it's important to ask them to do that part. What you have to do, you know, my point was always, you want to design technology in parallel with human awareness so that good choices are easy to make, bad choices are hard to make, and that we can take advantage of what people do. I mean, I know it's historically ancient, but, you know, going back to the cuckoo's egg, right? Where it was, for all the technology involved, it came down to a single determined human being who saw some anomaly that was written off by other human beings as unimportant, but they couldn't stand to leave it. And so they doggedly, you know, and so there's no replacement for that human sensor, for that, you know, for that. Humans are capable of incredible, you know, pattern matching that we haven't yet seen other machines, and intuition and, you know, determination that's just, you know, it's part and parcel of being a human. So I think there's a notion of how important that is. Again, there is no business, including ours, that exists without a core of IT and security around which the entire thing revolves. And so we have to deal with that. But let me offer, you know, and it was a great summary of all the things that we saw in there. And I guess what I would take away, Sean, as we wrap up, is that, you know, if you look at our tagline, right, confidence in a connected world. And it's a nice thing that says good things, and, you know, we still use it. I'm a fan, but we thought of connected. We were thinking primarily, frankly, of technology and the internet. We're connected, right? And that's a neat thing, and it's all good. But all those examples that people gave, we're connecting information and national interests and disinformation campaigns, right? And influencing human beings' behavior through, you know, flooding the zone and filling their space and all that. So connectivity now is taking on this much broader meaning. And, you know, we talk about things like hybrid threats or whatever, you know. So as we can share with our audience, as we explore the future of CIS, these are some of our conversations, right? We could hunker down and focus entirely on the technical problem. And it's important. That's always at the heart of us. But, you know, attackers use technology not to attack other technology, but to achieve goals like threat and influence and espionage and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so the ability to connect the intentions through technology to achieve an effect and back again is at the heart of what defense is evolving to become. And so we have to figure out what role can we play there uniquely. So I heard a lot of great ideas from people in the, you know, in the prediction space, which was around all those. And so I think for me, that does that say, you know, I think what we need to do is kind of rethink what connected means to CIS, right, as we chart our way forward, because the world is connecting in different ways than it ever has previously.
Agreed. Fantastic. Well, Tony, we got halfway through the list. So I think our next challenge is to come back and do the other half of the list, starting with Lee Myers, our Senior Director of Security Ops. But we'll conclude today. If you want to hear the next part or the second part of this particular series here, looking at our 12 predictions, we've been through six. You know, reach out to podcast@cisecurity.org. Make sure to catch us on YouTube at The CI Security. We're dropping episodes every Wednesday, so make sure to sign up for episodes like this and much, much more. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.